Hi, Jeff.
Oh, so should I start?
Everyone's listening.
I'm sorry. Hey, folks. Sitting here in the void, Jeff Salzman here with Terry Patton and Diane Hamilton. On tech, we have Brett Walker and Ben Levy. And welcome to the Integral Living Room monthly chat that we have in preparation for this event that we're doing October 31st through November 3rd. So it's coming up here in 6 weeks or so in Boulder, at Boulder Integral, which we're recovering from the flood. It's been a hard week here in Boulder. And the Integral Center was indeed flooded in the basement, but we're working on it. And at any rate, the place is very functional and we're full speed ahead. And really, sort of extra excited about this event, and not just because of the event, but because of the topic. And that is that we're really delving into what is this enlightenment in the lower left, if you will. What is the enlightenment of we? Where together, not as individuals, which we've all done plenty of practice as individuals in terms of meditation and consciousness practice. But what is it to actually work together in this whole other, irreducible realm of reality, as integral theory teaches us? And there are a lot of people in the integral world who are really working on this. And I could name a bunch of them, but I won't bother because we all know who they are, and it is a worthy task. And so tonight, what we have is a conversation that Terry and Diane and I had with Ken Wilber 2 days ago, where we're talking about it, because Ken is very much a part of the living room and very much a part of this whole inquiry and very interested in it. And you'll hear from him tonight and get a transmission of that, I hope. So we had a conversation with Ken, which we are going to replay about 50-some minutes of it tonight because it was so brilliant and really helped Diane and Terry and I to really enter a deeper inquiry and sort of a deeper engagement with what it is we're doing, which is really, as Ken will point out, right on schedule in terms of the integral movement. And so it really has been a thrilling week in that way. And I guess I'll just stop there with that introduction and again, welcome everybody. Terry, I know you've been, or Di, I think you're next, right?
I'm just going to say hi quickly, and then we'll turn it over to Terry to introduce the call. But thank you, everybody, for being on the line. And thank you, Ben Levy and Brett Walker, for your technical support, and Jeff and Terry. Always a pleasure to join you on the line. And thanks, everybody, all of you curious integralists who are working a lot with other human beings and interested in kind of what the next steps of our communion are, and what the interiors look like when we start working together differently, and also what are the structures and the injunctions and the different things we can do to actually sort of support our working together. And as Jeff mentioned, we have this really great call that we did with Ken, which we actually were only planning to use an excerpt or two for tonight's call, but we loved it so much that we're going to share a full hour. The call itself was an hour and 45 minutes, but we're going to take a full hour from the call and really share it with you. Because Ken does such a great job of framing some of the questions that we're going to be exploring at the Integral Living Room, questions like, what do we mean by an awakened we? What is the relationship of states and structures when it comes to our belonging? What is the role of the impersonal, and how personal should we get? And should we work on our shadow together? Does that matter? Just kind of really fundamental questions that are framed by the theory, but also really give us a kind of shared map for starting to talk about and integrate all the work that you're doing and all the many different forms that you're using in your work. I do want to apologize because for some reason, might just be that I failed to update the software in my cell phone, but I tend to not be very clear on the call, which I've heard in the past has been the case too. So I made a long trek just to get on the landline tonight. So I hope you guys can appreciate my effort. Anyway, thanks everyone for being on the call. Take it away, Terry.
Thank you, Di. And it's so great to hear you so crystal clear. You have such a lovely voice when I can hear it. Technicolor. Yeah, thank you, everybody, for joining. I think everything that needs to be said has been said. We can go into the call here in just a minute. The one thing I'd like to mention to you is if for some reason you have to leave this call before this recording is over, come back and listen to the recording of it later, because it builds to something of a crescendo. And the way that this process of building through our practices and through what's happening in our experiments, something that really can and will and is changing the world in very practical ways that will manifest in all four quadrants, really comes clear in the end. And that's what's especially exciting about this excerpt for me.
Can I ask one quick technical question? Do you think it would be possible for us to post the call in its entirety on the site so that if people
want to... We are planning to, yes. We're going to post this call exactly as it is and then the call with Ken in its entirety, both at the Integral Living Room site after this. It'll probably take a day or so for that all to get up.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, everybody. We're ready to go. Ben, please start the recording.
There's another force that comes into being in any inner subjective field. One of them, of course, is a force of transcendence. But another is a force of regression. Mobs will do things that individuals will never do. And I think Jane Lovinger, I'd mentioned, she had done some tests where she found on average that groups of individuals acted on average two stages lower than the individuals themselves were at.
Wow.
So there's that pull. And what one of the things that we're doing in we-space practices, when we say let's learn how to do a better we, one of them is, let's learn how to not regress when we get together. Let's learn how to make this we a transcendental we and not a mob, and not get caught what Madison called the tyranny of the majority. Now, that hasn't been practiced a lot. Most human we practice is mob practice. And so even things like democracy are, you know, still trying to be figured out, because there's so many ways they can get pulled down into mob actions. So an integral we space is a space that has it and its and I, you know, present and having their impact. But you're also trying to take the we space among all of that and advance it, move it forward, make it more beautiful or more good or more truthful, more honest, more open, more transparent. And then, of course, learn ways to move into that unknown area. And those have to be trans-rhetorical. In many cases, they have to be transferable. In some cases, they have to be trans-rational. And here, of course, is where we want to watch the pre-trans fallacy, because that can always jump up. And it's one of the things that makes a mob.
Mm-hmm.
So all of those factors are there and implicit. But what we're doing is focusing on how to take that we out, that inner subjective nexus, and turn it into something that in most cases it hasn't been historically, which is that it could be a new Buddha. It never has been. But so why not? We're at a stage where individuals are able to include and appreciate every previous stage of development. That's never happened. That's radically new, second tier. So if that's new in an I space, then there's got to be something correlatively new in a we space. Mm-hmm. We don't know exactly what that is. We don't know exactly how to do that. Hell, we still don't know very well how to transform eyes. But we have a lot more, you know, experience and practice and records. And so we have a lot more things we can, quote, teach people. But here in the we space, its initial stages are exploratory as much as anything. And so that's what makes them exciting and sometimes frustrating. And sometimes you hit on things, you know, that work well, and other times things that don't work well. And I think probably when Carrie first stood up and stopped talking third person and went into a kind of first person confessional stance, that is probably a pretty spooky moment for it.
Yeah, for sure.
And that took a lot of courage or stupidity, depending on how you want to look at it. Both can be helpful.
Those words aren't synonyms.
But now it's become, because we realize that there is a new space in eyes, that there's a new space in we's. And so that's what we're trying to figure out.
Jeff, I interrupted you. Do you want to return to what you were going to ask? Thank you, Ken.
Yeah.
Thing.
Jeff?
Yeah? Jeff?
Maybe he's muted.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm muted, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's so right. We're learning. We have the questions right. We don't exactly know what we're doing. We're exploring our way into it. And there's some things that we can. I was intrigued by what you said about Lovinger, where groups work two stages lower.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
if you know, we're sort of tealish, you know, maybe bumping into turquoise from time to time, we're working as an integral as a group, often at orange and green, and that's actually quite true.
Yeah.
When I think of the integral groups, we're often doing that.
I know.
And that's just as interesting as a thought experiment, so thank you for that.
Yeah.
And I think that some of what we do is we work our way into integral as we see what doesn't work at those levels. And I think back in what you said a minute ago about trying to be a group without being individuals and how hard, impossible that is. But that's sort of the MO of green. When I think of the circles I sat in at Naropa, where they would be so deadened, and if anybody actually tried to rise up in any kind of vivid way, it would be like cutting yourself in front of Dracula. You would be immediately deconstructed by the group.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
So we don't want to do that.
That was my point when I said, you know, that the motives are saying the new Buddha will be the Sangha are very, very mixed. And in a large measure, they're nothing but green. And that's one of the problems, is how to make a we space that isn't green.
Right. Well,
I would actually almost frame that as one of the central problems. Because you're exactly right. It, you know, green we spaces are deadening, and they are anti-creative and anti-novelty and anti-individuality and anti-holarchy, and it's nothing but a kind of systematic, everybody has to say what they're feeling.
That's where the individual does get to come forward in green. If you're crying, then we all have to stop.
Yeah,
you know?
That's true.
And that's what kind of crazy, it's a little crazy making, you know.
Exactly.
So.
And so individuality is really looked on in almost demonic terms.
Yeah.
And I don't know what that is, but that's not an integral we. And so I think one of the things that when the excitement shows up, and people feel that they're really onto something new, and that this might even be a strange attractor for the world, I have virtually no doubt that when that happens, people are largely at second tier, and they are also tapping into settler causal states, maybe even non-dual. And that's what makes those we spaces extraordinary. And we have to realize that those are going to be we spaces that most of the world are simply not going to get. You can't have an integral we space if you have somebody at first tier who, whenever they hear some other value, is going to roll their eyes. But first of all, you can't generate trust that way. Nobody trusts anybody, and rightly so, because everybody at first tier is going to make fun of any other stage the first chance they get. So it's nothing but a bunch of eye-rolling contestants. And whatever kind of we space is going to be formed, well, they're out there all over the place, but they're not integral, and they're not causing the kind of excitement that some of these we practices are when they hit and are on the mark. So we're at that difficult position that integral has always been in, of being, you know, an elitism to which everybody is invited. But there is at least a component of certain requirements for adequacy. And that tends to go unsaid because it's politically incorrect.
Ken, that really begs a really important question for the Integral Living Room event that we're going to be doing soon, which is that since all of us are going to be people who function variously at different levels, and we're not all consistently operating at turquoise or even teal, there are injunctions that can ask us all to fly a little higher and to draw ourselves into the orientations that can enable our enable us to show up adequate to a higher level of space when we get together. And those, the praxis that I'm most aware of tend to be about what it takes for us to show up at a higher state. And because higher states are provocative turbochargers for higher stages, that seems like the thing I know best how to do, reminding people with pointing out instructions about relaxing into witnessing, orienting to the present moment, the kinds of things I mentioned earlier, that there's a kind of, you know, maybe having some third-person framing before we go into the practices. All those things are really helpful.
Right.
But there may be some particular ways of setting the conditions that prevent that regression into a lower we space that you would want to point us to. And I'd be curious to hear any comments you have along those lines.
Injunctions and structures, just even the way you set a classroom style versus a circle versus time and using time frames. So I just want to broaden Terry's question to include structures as well.
Sure. I think what we're looking at is what can we do to help individuals come from both the highest state that they can come from and the highest structure that they can come from. And so many of the things that Terry mentioned are practices and injunctions for coming from causal and non-dual states. And those are all absolutely important and definitely deserve, you know, a bit of a mention, and perhaps even, you know, a little bit of introductory brief practice. But certainly surrendering into witnessing, and at the minimum, non-dual awareness is even better, but it's harder to get people into. It's a little easier to talk individuals into an observing self, a witnessing self. than it is to talk people into getting rid of the looker entirely. And when you look at a table, there's just the table arising and no subject aware of it. As the table sees itself, there's just a non-dual awareness. That can be a little trickier, but witnessing will do. But that's important for a higher state. And then, of course, present focused is central. And I would say those are at least two of the state injunctions that can be most useful in helping people get into causal or non-dual states. Little reminders like allowing the self-contraction to uncoil in the vast expanse of all space, calling forth big mind. Any of those can help. And then for structures, there's one in particular that is, as far as I can tell, is actually an old Quaker practice. But it seems to be very effective. And that is, may the next words out of my mouth, and we keep repeating this throughout the evening, to ourselves anyway, let the next words out of my mouth come from my highest self. And this is something that is said to the group. So you actually have a bit of a feedback mechanism of everybody looking to see, okay, what's your highest self going to say? And so there actually is a pressure to really dig deep or high, and certainly not, some idiotic red or amber structure. And so that can be very helpful, so that in addition to being present and witnessing, being possibly in big mind, the self-contraction uncoiled and relaxed, and surrendering into the present moment in that attitude of witnessing and letting come, is that when actual structures pass through your mind, select the one that in your best judgment comes from the highest part of you. And that can help at least orient structures towards the highest that the individual can find as they're looking for something to say. Now, you can also, at some point, and this just depends entirely on the type of we practice you're doing, you can start to try and make that slightly difficult, and not always to be sought after, but in some cases, the transition of trying to feel the inner subjective nexus as your highest self. Now, theoretically, that's a little bit off, but subjectively, that will tend to be how it feels. And the idea, of course, is that it's not really your highest self. It's your highest we. But you can get into a feeling of it and identifying with the network and opening to that higher we by actually trying to sort of feel it as an I, feel it as your own highest self, feel it as your own deepest being. And in a partial sense, that's true, because what everybody is ultimately expressing is the one true self or one big mind. But at some point, if that is what the we practice is going for, is a direct experience of a group intelligence, then you can translate that, let the next words out of my mouth be from my highest self, to let the next words out of my mouth be from this highest intelligence. And then that also has a kind of pressure on it to see, well, just how high is this intelligence, you know, that's being downloaded in you. That can be useful at that point. But simply let the next words out of my mouth be from my highest self, or let the next words out of my mouth be from big mind, however one wants to do it, can help to really notch up structures.
One of the things that I would like to also explore, because I think to the extent that we do it in the same way in our integral life practice, that we would do the spiritual dimension of the practice and we would work on, you know, the physicality, like we'd probably want to include some group physical practice together. I think in order to support the movement to big mind, we need a simultaneous collective shadow practice, so that there's a space in which the unintegrated parts of ourselves and the unspoken things and the seedier side of what goes on can actually get surfaced and made conscious, so that in a certain way, the more that we consciously let ourselves regress and really see it and own it, it kind of builds a platform for, to some degree, a more transcendent and certainly more highly integrated interpersonal interaction. So I think we probably want to include some collective shadow practice during the weekend as well. What are your thoughts on that, Ken?
Well, shadow practice is certainly part of any integral practice. And so if you're talking about an integral we, shadow elements are one of the elements that can most severely disrupt group trust and group enactment. And I often define the shadow as the locus of the lie. So it's also just a flat-out untruthfulness. And to the extent that it's really
right. Shadow,
yeah. You know, the person doesn't know that they're being untruthful. That's the point. You lie, and then you forget it's a lie. You actually believe it. And so having that pointed out at some point could be a good idea. And I think we just have to be careful, because it can be an almost endless process.
Yeah.
It can bring up a lot of defenses and put mm-hmm. people into an argumentative, defensive mode. Mm-hmm. And so if we do that, it might be better. I'm not saying we have to do it this way, but it might be better to discuss it in third terms.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And just invite people to apply it to themselves if they feel that it's appropriate, mm-hmm. and not actually get people engaged in mm-hmm. personal shadow confession and acknowledgement.
Right.
You know, some people will be willing to do that, and some people will get very, very defensive.
Yeah, and it may be that in my own practice, when the way that I generally work with it is, we go along, and then the sort of, you might say, a marginalized opinion actually starts coming up, and you can start feeling it in the energy of the room, and you start feeling it affecting what's happening, and then usually at that point is the point where I just will start to name it, and then as we name it, we try to look at what the wisdom of it is, so that finding the wisdom kind of lowers the fear.
Right.
Fear part of it. And that's something maybe we can do. Again, I think the point you're making is a good one, and unless people are skilled, it can sort of hijack group processes, and then people get afraid that conflict and shadow work is just the dominating discourse. But it really isn't about that. It's really about when it does start to arise in a group, to be able to ventilate or transmute it quickly is really
good. Right.
Because in the past in our development, when things we were operating at a more dualistic level, then the way we worked with shadow was to exile and to cut something out and get rid of something. We don't seem really to be able to do that in the domains we're working in. So the question is, how can it be acknowledged and transmuted efficiently? I think that's a great distinction that you're making, because nobody wants to get bogged down in group conflict that never gets liberated. That makes sense.
Yeah, and particularly if something really does start to emerge that is starting to become obvious to a fair number of people and is actually kind of derailing the process.
Yeah.
Then
okay.
I think, stopping and taking a moment to deal with that is definitely warranted.
Yeah. Okay, that was really clarifying for me. Thank you.
Yeah. You know, Ken, it's just occurring to me right now that we may talk about all kinds of different topics in the course of the Living Room event, but
yeah,
one of the things that's been reflected back to us is that there are two key questions that seem to be really upon people. One of them is the larger world crisis, the kind of question that I posed in my paper.
Right.
And the other is the big questions that affect us as a community, like in what ways can we as integral practitioners, as the integral community, evolve our community? In what ways are we going to sleep? What is our shadow? What, you know, such that we in our group practices can be dynamic in relation to the domain where we have more direct efficacy and influence.
Right. Right.
And as you imagine us going into these, because in each case you could say we're venturing into inquiry or into these open-ended questions or koans, there's a potential for something real to be catalyzed, for something fruitful to emerge, for the
right.
exercise to bear real fruits and results that can make a difference. What do
right.
you think is the grounded and realistic hope? What would you find most exciting as we press into both those questions, kind of the global questions and then the more local questions of our own community?
Well, I think both of them are pressing issues. And there are, you know, landmines connected with both. The world crisis situation is, you know, ultimately, in many ways, it has directly to do with things that integral theory is itself directly concerned with. So one of them would be, for example, just the general development of altitude of items that are driving, you know, the world problems. I mean, if you have 70% of the world at ethnocentric or lower, you have zero chance for world peace. And so those all become directly important issues. And, the questions are all, a lot of the answers are variations on how can you take virtually any dimension of the AQUA framework and make it larger, make it more inclusive, make it greater, increase the good or the true or the beautiful in any way that you possibly can. And one of the things that, if we go into that, one of the things that I would be bringing up is something that I think is important, and that is, just very briefly, if you look at, for example, the work on morphogenetic fields, and when you have a large protein that's just been synthesized, there are literally 1,000 ways that protein could fold. But once it folds into one way, and then another protein folds that way, and then another, pretty soon, that's the only way proteins will fold. And every time that protein is synthesized, it will immediately fold into that one way, and that way only. Now, we see this with any growth and development anywhere. When the red structure was first forming, it had to transcend and include its previous structures. But then within that, it could have formed in any number of ways. But as one way started to form and was repeated, then that came to be the one and only deep structure that red has. And so if you go anywhere in the world today and look at red, it's got an identical deep structure. And you can't change it. You can change the surface structure, but not the deep structure. So where are those deep structures? Where do they exist? Where there's any of the left-hand qualities exist? Where does mutual understanding exist, and so on? And so one of the points is that, back to the Whitehead tetraprehension, that every time a particular thought or feeling or emotion or idea comes up and you think about it, feel it, download it, or whatnot, you're adding to that structure wherever they're stored. The point is, you don't have to do anything but think it or feel it. And you are adding to that cumulative storehouse structure that the Lakhavatara Sutra talks about, that they maintain is, you know, stored in the upper causal regions. Mm-hmm. Still nothing. It's just something you can put your finger on or directly see. But simply thinking certain types of thoughts or activities, or simply thinking in an integral fashion, is actually stored in cosmic memory and will become part of a cosmic groove that is itself more integral. And so you can actually have an impact on world problems by thinking about them integrally, because those will be structures that are stored along with the folded protein and the deep structure of red and all the other structures that there are cosmic memories that form cosmic habits. And what happens, of course, when something actually comes to fruition is that some sort of majority of individuals are thinking in essentially similar ways. And then when that happens, you'll have a French or American Revolution, or you'll have the rise of environmentalism, or you'll have the rise of representative democracy, or so on. And so we're not wasting time just by going over integral approaches to these problems. Of course, it also helps if you then get, you know, politically involved and do stuff in the lower right. But that's often limited. And the point is that even if it is limited, there are things you can do to help problems become more solvable by being approached in more integral fashions. And that's by simply going over integral solutions in your own mind or discussing them with a group of people. So that's an important part of the tetraprehension of every moment. Every single thought, deed, feeling, and action we have is stored in the storehouse memory. And so it has an impact. It has an effect. And so it's not, and often you can't see it. So we have no idea the ways in which integral thinking is having an impact on the world. There's that statement you quoted that, you know, we're looking at miles, but, you know, moving in inches. We don't know how we're moving.
Right.
You know, there was just like that recent British government official report on climate adaptability, and it's like 500 pages. long and had to go through massive peer review. And it's a judgment of the British capacity to meet climate change. And it's done with an aqual analysis. It uses quadrants, levels, and lines, and names it that. And so that's now official British policy. So where did that come from? Like it just dropped out of the blue. Well, it dropped out of the storehouse consciousness. And so we're seeing these kinds of things happen a lot. So, you know, continuing to discuss it and think about it and so on can have these kinds of powerful effects. So I think it's a good question in general, because it, you know, people want to know, well, how can, you know, what we're doing here have an actual impact on the real world? And of course, the obvious answers are, well, you can get involved in politics, or you can try to get political changes and so on. But there are other less obvious ways that help. Mm-hmm. And then as for how can we as a community move forward, that's a clearly an important question. It's also a very touchy question. And one of the reasons is that Jeff was saying earlier that a lot of what, you know, an integral group ends up doing is orange or green. And that's exactly right. And as we've seen a diversification of integral organizations, which on balance I think is great, but as you look at them all, you can't help but notice, you know, sort of the degree of greenness in some of them. On the one hand, others have a great deal of green allergy, and both of those are problems. And so whenever you are discussing that issue, it you know, it's hard. It's almost like discussing in public, you know, who's an enlightened spiritual teacher and who isn't. That can be a very delicate thing to get into. And it's the same with, you know, what as a community should we do? Since many of these different organizations have rather different ideas on what should be done and on what the main problem is. And a lot of these, I personally find, are just nowhere near second tier. And so all that does is, you know, irritate people. And so I find it hard to publicly comment on some of those issues. I don't know how y'all feel, but you know, any public discussion generally ends up being fairly, you know, generic about these issues.
Yeah, I would agree.
I think that's so well put.
And my own experience of kind of being in the integral community and imagining for a moment that the second tier in some dimension recapitulates first tier, you know, I would say that part of my experience is that we're unstable as a community in our own development. So, you know, at moments, one of us, myself, might function at quite a high level of development, but in the next moment feel threatened, or like I need to make more money, or suddenly these aren't the people I can work with, or whatever it happens to be. So there's a sort of a natural instability in terms of our level of development. And then I also think this thing about how it recapitulates first tier is that because we don't know, it's sort of like beige, you know, you're just trying to get sea legs, you know. We're trying to get our sea legs. So part of what I feel like I've experienced has been kind of a massive amount of prototyping, a lot of which has failed. And but there's something so deep and so genuine that while lots of models are failing, there is a coherence in our relationships and in our dedication to you, to to the theory and also to our own experience of what we might call integral consciousness, that in spite of these failures, we remain in community. So even though we don't have kind of whatever second-tier structures that might, we're not ready to recapitulate amber structures, but, you know, let's imagine turquoise recapitulates purple at some level, you know, that there is a tribe, and that tribe is very loose, that I go to an event in Houston not expecting to see anybody, and 50 or 60 people show up who are all deeply involved in your work and who I saw 8 years ago there.
The problems is that I think as a community, we are expecting a little bit too much out of the community at this point in its evolution. Because we're talking right now about the fact that we really don't have a rule book on how to form an integral we. So how on earth would we have a rule book about how to form an integral organization?
Right, we don't know.
We don't. And so these integral organizations have about the same success rate, if you will, as various we practices do. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they hit, sometimes they miss. But none of them are, you know, absolutely firmly established. And there's dozens and dozens of different types of them. What they all have in common is a certain sort of framework and vocabulary. But there are so many different ways to take that we space. And what they all have in common is that they're driven by a new and higher series of I spaces. And so that's what makes it interesting.
Yeah.
But we also are still working on ways to transform people into second tier. In other words, ways to create integral eyes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And again, we have several different approaches, and many of them are promising and optimistic. But we still, you know, don't understand particularly the developmental part very well. Psychologists still don't know how people really transform. And so the number of practices that even conventional psychologists have created to develop people in their particular model is really pretty anemic. And yet, of course, it's a group of particularly intelligent people that got very excited by reading material that pointed out their own integral I space. And for the first time they felt like, you know, somebody was talking about where they were and they recognized the territory they were at. And this was all exciting and very new. And so that was, you know, that was fun and that was great. But then how to carry that forward in all four quadrants is still a completely open question.
So people are holding the question in spite of the prototyping that is kind of, you know, doesn't endure necessarily. I'm very impressed by people's willingness to keep asking, which
right.
I think is worth a lot.
And of course, we have no option but to do that.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, whenever, you know, people find something that they know is good, they can't help but want to share it and get it out there and make it available and tell others about it and get others excited and so on. I mean, that's just, you know, something that we're, you know, just pretty much a course of action that, you know, we'll be on for some time.
Well, Ken, the one gem, there are many, that comes out of this conversation for me is just the power of actually thinking about these things. Thank
right.
you for that. Mm-hmm. As somebody
yeah.
who's pretty good at thinking and not much else, that's very comforting.
Yeah, and talking, having the conversation, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think that's one of the things that we can remind people of at this event, is that we're getting together and engaging this question together, is we're putting grooves in the cosmos here.
Absolutely.
That are important and steering the ship. And
absolutely,
that relaxes me, because then I don't feel, you know, there's so much of this in the integral world, if we're tired of thinking about it and talking about it, we want to do something, it's like, okay, well, fine, but let's keep thinking and talking about it too.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's all major historical moments were preceded by usually hundreds of years of thinking about it.
So true.
And, I mean, you know, it was from the Renaissance to the Enlightenment before representative democracy came into action. That wasn't something that somebody just thought of in a year or two later. They went out and had French and American revolutions. So we're still at that phase. And, you know, the demand for action and so on is fine, but it's also in many ways premature. And it also overlooks the storehouse cosmic grooves that we are creating the more we talk about it, the more we think about it. And, you know, just even conceiving issues in integral terms cuts a groove in the cosmos that will never go away, ever. And so that's an impact that you are having every single time you think integrally. That's a profound cut in the cosmos. It's an ontological reality. And that's what's so important. I think it's certainly one of the things that we would want to get across to people.
I know we're close to the end of our time, but something occurs to me to ask you about in the midst of that conversation you just shared with Jeff, which is, you remember that section of my paper where I advocated for urgency.
Right.
And where I said that we don't really even try if we don't try to do it now. If we don't say, it's not like I'm going to do this because that'll create the conditions for something to happen later, and that when we do that in some way, we don't take as seriously our intention to make a real difference immediately. And that there's a value in contemplating crisis, because if we can take on the urgency of that situation without becoming contracted and losing our fundamental freedom and well-being and knowledge of the prior perfection of everything, if we can take it seriously and really go for it as if it matters and we have to do it now, a kind of quickening is in the field that can often bleed out. And as you were advocating the importance of building the integral worldview, the integral we space, the integral understandings, the kinds of things that took so long historically, but which are taking less and less time as we evolve.
Yeah.
It can seem to be an argument against urgency, and I know you hold both sides of that enduring polarity. Could you say something about how those two integrate with each other?
Sure. It all depends on seeing that thoughts are things. Thoughts have the same ontological reality as empirical objects. They're phenomena that arise in a real world space, whether that world space is magenta or red or amber or orange or teal or turquoise or indigo or violet or ultraviolet. Those world spaces are all as real as the sensory motor world space. And therefore the phenomena in them are as real as sensory motor phenomena. And therefore, you can develop, if you see that and get correct thinking on that issue, then there can be urgency about thinking exactly as there can be urgency about objects in the sensory motor world. There is an urgency to think these things through in an integral fashion. And that is a thing. That is a real thing. And we are creating a thing that exists in a teal and turquoise world space as a real phenomena. And we don't have enough of that phenomena. We need more of it urgently. And that's why these conversations and these kinds of meetings and the type of writing that anybody does, the types of seminars that anybody does, are helping to create teal and turquoise objects, actual, ontologically real things. And those things are also just happen to be part of a list of items that are required to convert interior things into exterior things. So there is an urgency about individual freedom starting in the Renaissance. And the urgency originally was to make that thought a real thing, to realize it was a real reality that could be put into place in the real world. And it took a couple hundred years for that to happen. But the first person that said, oh, individual freedom is important, didn't go out and start a French Revolution. They would have gotten nowhere. The urgency was in thinking it through and populating the orange world with enough ontologically real phenomena about individual freedom that has started to spill over into the exterior world. And at that point, there was enough stuff to back actions in the sensory motor world. And it wasn't that the actions in the sensory motor world weren't urgent. They were, but so were the creating the internal objects. There was an urgency about that. And that actually had to happen before action in the exterior world could take place. Because otherwise people really had no idea what they were doing. And everybody had a different idea about individual freedom, and nobody would work together, and you couldn't create cohesive we spaces. And all of those just happened to be prerequisites of any sort of action in the lower right quadrant. And so there was an enormous, there was 200 years of urgency. And originally only a few people got the idea. And so it was a very small number of people that shared the ideas and started to form very small we groups. And then that went all the way up to things like the salons in the cafes of Paris. Mm-hmm. And the urgency to the dialogue continued. And as it did, it continued to build orange objects. And there were more and more and more of those. And more people started to realize that those were real realities. Those were, quote, just thoughts. Those were real phenomena in a real orange world space. And that not everything that was real was merely in the sensory motor world. And there's this whole interior world that's just as real. In fact, in many cases, more real, because it has more depth. And so that's a type of urgency that if people understand that, whenever they are simply, quote, thinking about these things, they're actually creating real ontological objects that are being stored as cosmic grooves in the real cosmos, they would stop looking at it as mere thinking and start seeing it as actual building. And the more they realize they're actually building something, then they can do it with urgency and with passion and with awareness and with desire and with ragged truth-telling. They don't have to go out and start a revolution tomorrow. So I'm all in favor of urgency. I just want all objects to at least be put on equal footing in terms of the urgency of creating them and then the urgency of sharing them and creating we spaces that are sharing those objects. And we're just getting to that.
Yeah.
And so until we at least have we spaces that with the same urgency as individuals had thought through turquoise objects, and then we get we spaces that are thinking intersubjectively about bringing we spaces into the world, then we have enough objects to carry into the sensorimotor world. And we'll be able to create lower right institutions that reflect those interior objects, and they are, as a matter of fact, simply their exterior correlates. But like I say, we're still at a bit early in evolution to even know how to get we spaces together reliably, let alone, therefore, how to go out and create a integral organization reliably. We still don't have rules for how to create integral business reliably. It's on a lot of people's minds, and that has to happen. They're building, in many cases, if you can call it that, integral orange objects. But that's what they're trying to do. And when they get a bundle of those cosmic grooves cut, then they'll have guidelines that they can carry into the actual sensorimotor world of business and start to have an impact. But all of the meetings, and like John Mackey has just done his book on conscious capitalism, and it's a start. It's hardly the final word. And I would hate to see all of that put into action tomorrow, urgently. But that would be a disaster. So we need more turquoise objects on conscious capitalism before we're going to really have enough faith in them to put them into law.
That's such an inspiring vision you just laid out, and in a way, it's a manifesto for the revolutionary impact of the work we're envisioning and intending to convene at the Integral Living Room. It's a beautiful expression. Thank you so much, Ken.
Excellent. I mean, that's what we've all been doing, and so you know, to charge us with not taking action in this area is derelict. It's cruel and it's stupid. It can't happen without what all of you are doing. I'm dead serious.
Well, that's a rousing end to our conversation with Ken, and I imagine that a lot of you have been activated by listening to this too. So I want to give us a chance to begin to have a conversation in a kind of focused way. We don't have a lot of time, just another 20 minutes or so before we're going to finish this call. But I want to invite people to raise your hands by pressing 1 on your keypad, and if you
can share just, you know, a one breath share, just a quick response with what's stirred up, what questions are coming alive. We're involved right now in a process of clarifying and doing the fine-tuning of our design of the event, and we want to come together on October 9th and take another pass at this. So getting a feeling for what's here in the field from you will be really helpful. So we'd like to take a series of responses just quickly and get a feeling for what's here in the community that's on the line. So I'll begin. Kevin O'Connell has raised your hand. Hi, Kevin.
Oh, hi. Yeah, thanks for taking my question. What I'm concerned about is being able to discern like a pre from a trans rational thought. And in addition to that, learning the language of understanding where people are coming at in terms of their altitude, so I can learn and connect with their language.
Thank you. Great.
Thanks.
All right.
Well, I just want to point out that Ken also talked about the pre-trans fallacy earlier in the call, and he also talked about the way in which our worldviews will shape our interactions and, you know, how, depending on where we're at. So learning how to recognize those different worldviews becomes really important. So thanks for that. Those are important.
Yeah. Well, make a point of listening to the full conversation with Ken when we're able to post that. Bev Roche, hi.
Hi. This was really exciting to listen to, and anticipating the upcoming Integral Living Room, I got so electrified by the notion, which I hadn't heard before, that the next Buddha was going to be a Sangha. And just playing with that notion, and I'm a therapist who's spent years in doing group work, and every now and then this quickening force that's been described in different ways will emerge through the group and has a powerful uplifting and sometimes transcending effect on participants. But it's hard to always know what all the ingredients are that go in to create that kind of the evolutionary impact that will come through a group, but it's a little bit unpredictable. And one of the things I'm excited about is the challenge that you guys face and how to sculpt this experience to activate as much of that that may be possible.
Thank you, Bev.
Yeah, that's really nicely framed, Bev. I think that's actually part of what I keep talking about earlier in the call, but we actually talked about replication and how we do have these experiences, but they're hard in some ways to capture and replicate. We certainly don't have a formula for that. And I think
yes.
Jeff and Terry and I all feel, you know, that part of our charge is to try to put the structures, the injunctions, the right combination of people in the space so that we can have maybe more of that experience rather than less. So, great. It's something we're definitely going to be looking into. Awesome. Thank you.
So,
and could I also add that isn't it interesting how Ken talked about the arising of rational and the arising of modernism and how it probably was kind of catch as catch can to get people to sit down and actually turn their attention to a problem or sit in a row or, you know, the things that we all take for granted now as part of just sort of a modern we space. And at one point that was experimental and that was unpredictable. And
yes.
we're building that groove, the new groove now, as they did then.
It's exciting.
Yeah, cool.
And by the way, I've asked somebody who's on the call to record your questions and also just to make note of what's exciting you, because we'll be working with that between now and the next call. So.
Yeah. And in fact, we're interested to solicit additional input even beyond what there may be time for right now. We'll talk about that at the end.
Great. I can do that.
Carrie, hello. Are you there? Carrie Dickey Clark?
I am here. Can you hear me?
Yes. Hi.
Hi there. I'm just so excited to be a part of what we're up to here. It feeds me on so many levels of my being. I'm out here in the middle of the Pacific Ocean in Hawaii and can't get to the Living Room event. However, I was wondering about if somebody would talk to me about, are you familiar with open space technology?
Yes.
And I was wondering, you know, what levels or stages or colors or states does that kind of fall into? And is that something that might be worth exploring in the event?
Yeah, well, I think we probably shouldn't be answering that so much as soliciting input from different places, but I can say that it's a very rich and fun way to engage a group conversation, but it tends to be the form, and we're looking to move among different forms, so we won't be able to do it in a strict fashion, but it will inform mm-hmm. it will definitely inform our design. I can promise you that.
Well, I mean, I was just thinking in terms of the self-organizational aspect of it and how that helps.
Exactly. That's why this solicitation of input right now is so important. Like hearing mm-hmm. conversations people want to have, which is what open space brings forward. The, mm-hmm. you know, hey, I want to talk about this or that, helps to catalyze things, and that's the essence of open space. Well, thank you,
yeah.
Carrie. Let's see, Catherine Cannon.
Hi.
Hi.
Oh, this conversation, listening to Ken, it is so groundbreaking. It created so much clarity for me personally, and in that it really does. It's about me for my activity. It's really about continuing. Deepening my contemplative meditation practices, writing, thinking, talking, integral in my work, everywhere I can get the conversation, the thoughts, keep reading, I'm listening to everything available, keep doing that. And it was so clear how we are creating the cosmic growth. This is revolutionary. This is breakthrough. And I'm also reminded how the philosophy I adhere to, it's like we have the will, we're growing in knowledge, action will follow, we'll know what to do, we will do it, it'll just roll out there. And it's about creating, you know, building will and knowledge, creating the conversation. So I think it's absolutely powerful. It is groundbreaking. I'm just thrilled to be part of this. And one other issue is we were discussing ways of, this is something I've been practicing in order to create a we space that's powerful. I have been focusing on dropping into the heart. So when I even communicate with my clients or family members, I really take effort to come from the heart and thereby hoping to create a more, a loving space where more can go on and not get stuck in stuff. That pretty much summarizes, but I just love this call.
Thank you so much, Catherine. Good to hear from you. Andrew McDonald, hi.
Hi. I only caught the last part of the conversation, but I'm thrilled to be I've heard what I did hear. The concern that I often have in listening to so much stuff from Integral Life is I long to be part of the conversation and to hear those marginal voices from, I live in Canada myself, Ottawa, Canada, and I'd love to hear from the rest of us. I have a sense that it's a one-way information coming from the top down, and I want to hear and be part of more and more of the we space that we ourselves, all of us together, can we somehow create the we space ourselves rather than you know, kind of giving input so that somebody in Integral Living Room in Boulder or something does it for us. So that, I guess I'm just arguing for a radical democratization of the process so that we're all can hear all those voices and have a sense that we're co-creating it.
Thank you.
That's really my comment.
Yeah, I appreciate your comment. We'll be taking that down. You know, it occurs to me, Diane, that you might have some comment on that, or Jeff.
Well, I, you know, my comment is that the most creative polarity in all of reality is the relationship of the masculine to the feminine. So having really having what feels like a more hierarchical dimension along with a very powerful democratic dimension, that's where true creativity happens. So when you have really good leadership or really powerful vision or strong direction or a lot of passion, and that's joined with you know, a very pluralistic embrace of all opinions, which is really kind of this part of the call. We're opening the call up to actually get your responses in relationship to that particular download. I was recently at an event. I went to Burning Man out in the desert, and I was having a conversation all day long with someone about the problem of hierarchy. And I was saying to him, you know, you can't. It's really the axis. When hierarchy is out of balance or is predominant, you know, over the wider embrace, there's a problem. Anyway, we were going back and forth all day long, and then that evening we went to this club out in the middle of the desert, and the DJ was like, he was like nine stories high, you know, and I poked my friend and I said, "We love hierarchy, are you kidding? Check that out." So for me, it's a question of how do we actually find that sweet spot that is the most generative that there is. So
I'd echo that. This is Jeff. And I have the same impulse about, you know, democratization, and I think it's really important to hold that, as you say, that polarity. And I see that, you know, in order to have a democracy, you kind of have to have a crowd gathered. And often that crowd's gathered by a leader. And that's certainly true of at least this particular, you know, lineage of the Integral Movement, is that Ken Wilber, as a 20-year-old, started writing books and working as a dishwasher and, you know, magnetized people. And that as we look at the growth of the Integral Movement, since he's gone more public in the early parts of, you know, this last, the century, that it's been people who have been magnetized to him that have gone out and magnetized people into groups that are moving the ball. And so one of the great things about Integral is it's kind of a situation where everybody's invited to be a leader. I mean, maybe that's the ultimate democracy, but we do need that. So it's a little bit of a koan, and I, you know, appreciate the you know, question and the comment and the sentiment. I'm working on it too.
Absolutely, me too.
And you know, there's one little thing I'd like to add to that. Thank you guys for, I think, laying out the bulk of it. The other thing is, right on. That was actually our impulse in creating the Integral Living Room, was to create more space for that peer-to-peer generation, and we.
Yep.
Are very conscious of the fact that, you know, we are in some ways holding the leadership role, and that there are still limits to how democratized we're able to make this be, and we're wanting, in a sense, to defend the fact that there is a role for that leadership, that you end up with something kind of chaotic and shapeless if you don't have it. On the other hand, we actually hear your tune real loud, and we're acting on it. And in fact, it's that co-creation of the we that we're totally dedicated to, and it's being a midwife for something rather than authoring it all the time that is the whole nature of what we're up to here.
And another way to think about it is we have two very different pulses in our DNA. We have the DNA that comes from the chimps, and the chimps are all about power hierarchies, and everything is excited in their system by that. On the other side of our DNA is the bonobos, and there it's a much more, you know, to use the word, feminized culture, and they don't have those strict hierarchies. So I think it's important that we learn about both and really work as well as we can within that dimension. I'm repeating myself at this point, but anyway.
Beautiful. let's hear from some more voices. Aaliyah, hello. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. Can you hear me okay?
Just fine, yes.
Great. I'm going to try to laser this down. This ties back into, so one of you mentioned earlier when Ken was talking about hundreds of years, one of you just sort of slipped in the comment that it's not taking so long these days. And then it
yeah.
also ties into what we were talking about a few minutes ago about reliably producing this collective emergent intelligence, I call it. There, Ken doesn't get the exponential growth of consciousness. That's my opinion. I believe, and I've checked this out with Thomas Hubel, who works with these spaces, I believe there's a holarchy of morphic fields. And another way to put it is there's a groove of new grooves, so that every new groove that's created makes it easier for a new groove to be created. And this, there's a morphic field of morphic fields, as you will, if you will, and there's one for this new higher consciousness we space, and it is strengthening. It is showing up more easily in the world. And Thomas confirmed that when I asked him directly, hey, is this phenomenon showing up easier and faster and lasting longer and being more robust? And he said, huh, yes, over the last few years, he has observed it. I have observed it in my life. It is kind of like the field of fields, or the groove of new grooves, is, in Terry's terms, a thou. It is a second face, second person face of God. And I personally relate very strongly to it as a thou, which can be invoked. And I think when we invoke that, then the particular space that we're wanting to carry that vibration will more reliably show up.
Amen, sister.
Beautiful. Right on. I think that was a very substantive contribution, Aaliyah. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Whoops, I shut you up there. Okay. Thanks, Aaliyah. Let's hear at least from one other person. Pippa, hi.
Hi there. This comment goes back actually just a little bit, but I'm so interested in this idea of a non-green we space, because I do feel like when I see we spaces, often there is a sort of tendency for a pathological sort of flattening of things. And so I'm so interested in what we've started to allude to with this idea of the difference between a we space and an I space, and mainly the actual experience of an I within a we, and even a we within an I, and how they seem to deepen. One deepens when the other deepens. It's not a zero-sum game. And just that practical experience is what so deeply inspires me and what draws me to coming to the living room.
Really a great point, Pippa. Thank you. It's kind of analogous to what's been observed in among therapists about relationships, that without individuation, relationship isn't possible.
And we talked also on the call earlier about Ken actually begins the call by talking about experience arising in all four quadrants. So to talk about it deepening in all four quadrants as well. Like the deeper the eye goes, the deeper the structures are, then the deeper we're capable of going as well.
Yeah, and I for one am just really interested in exploring what is a non-green we space that's conscious. And I'm still in inquiry about that. I've seen it happen. I've been sort of accidentally, I stumble into it from time to time with my integral friends. And at least one characteristic I notice of it is that it sort of is able to accommodate rudeness. And I think what you call it, Terry, is ragged truth-telling,
yeah,
where you don't have to get it right somehow. And this is part of the inquiry. And, you know, Pippa, I'm so glad you're coming, and I guess I'll end there.
Yeah. Well, great. Thank you, Pippa.
Thank you.
Gosh, well, we're here pretty close to the end. Do we have time for one more?
I want to have time for one more. Let's do it. Deborah Jackson, welcome. Hi.
Hi. I thought I wasn't going to be on because you said the last person was the last one, so now I'm just going to have to remember what I was going to mention. It was primarily I wanted to say that, you know, what Ken was saying really, what stood out was a huge validation of, you know, what has been happening in these we spaces that I personally have found so incredibly frustrating since the first I think of it was I had some deep experiences with it with a small team doing some kind of high-minded work in year 2000, 2002. And we kind of stopped the work because I felt like we were dropping down, right, to those two tiers, so to speak. And I thought, my goodness, we, you know, how can we serve the work if we're, you know, if I could so clearly see that we were doing that. So I kind of went away from that expectation for a number of years, and in the last 3 years, I have really put myself out there, as you see, you know, so many more people really awakening, and I'm really excited about it. So I put myself out there in group after group and appreciative inquiry groups, if you know, you know, that sounds like the open space style, and again and again and again hit those same, you know, that flattening you're talking about. And so really I'm just kind of sharing that I'm another, you know, that it's so helpful to hear that it wasn't me, because I kept thinking, is it because where I live? Is it the area? Is it me? Are my expectations too high, which Ken said they were? You know, at this point, I mean, literally the last few months and the last few weeks and the last few days, I was finally settling into my own answers to all this, and they were all validated by what Ken was talking about. So I was finally setting into what I was seeing was real, you know, and it is pretty much across the board. Also settling into the idea that I'm going to have to lead it and keep it at this higher place, you know, if that's what I need. And that's what I need and desperately, desperately want. When working on some, you know, creative objects, as he was talking about. And so really I'm just, you know, initiating some work and extremely nervous about, I mean, in the projects I'm looking at, you know, require more and more people, large bodies of people, and I'm extremely nervous about trying to, you know, do work and hitting up against that again and again. But it's also really exciting, and now that it's kind of clear in my mind, this map of what is going on, it's, you know, this conversation has helped to further giving me permission to bring my highest self again and again and again, more so in that leadership capacity for the group, and also obviously calling upon others to bring it all the time. Because the work that we all want to see happen, you know, is that these, you know, we want to see teal.
Well, this is why we're pressing the edges here, and why this experiment is so vital for every one of us who is engaging groups and we spaces in our lives and need to break through these first tier limits that aren't creating the results we need. I really appreciate the vividness of your testimony there.
Right on.
I'm not signed up to come to, you know, the living room event you're having, and I'll honestly tell you, I discussed it with a close friend of mine of going or not, and the reason I didn't was I was afraid it was going to just be another experience of going in that place, even though I'm sure it would still be positive and, you know, not a waste, so to speak. But I thought, so many experiences like that, I thought, wow. And I'm in Cleveland, so, you know, it's kind of a trek, you know, to where you are and the whole thing, and I thought, you know, I just can't justify, you know, doing that. Again.
Well, we're here to make sure that you made a mistake.
Yeah. And I hope
we're a commitment to break your assumption. Thanks, Deborah.
I can't. Thank you.
I'd also just like to point out that the we space is is already being created, and that, you know, Ken's download or our hosting the call is in some way what we are holding, some sort of hosting or vertical dimension, if you will, in order for us to gather. And without that structure, without us putting that in place, then this group doesn't gather. It's just simply what we talked about in the beginning, which is not to say that if you've lived in really highly structured organizations with a lot of hierarchy, you've been in the military or you've, you know, been in a corporation or whatever it is where there's a lot of that, that entering into a group where suddenly there's so much space for each one's opinion and there's so much embrace and everybody, the specifics of each person is included and we're sitting in a circle, that can be an incredibly soothing and growthful experience at a particular moment in our development. So again, we have to be careful not to collapse our experience, but to keep looking through whatever we're doing through an evolutionary lens, because in one moment, command and control is an innovation in human consciousness. In the next moment, we have to, you know, level that hierarchy, create a larger circle, actually see the specifics of people, you know, get less action-oriented and bring more of people's subjectivity in, and then there's a point when people start to outgrow that and move into a next phase. So time is part of our experience. So is growth, and we're going to continue to see things grow and change. So what's brilliant in one moment is tired in the next, and the shadow is what always drives development.
Beautiful.
Right on.
Yeah, so thanks, everybody. Thanks for joining our call. And Terry, thank you.
And
for
those of you who we, you know, there were a lot of hands in the air. We didn't get the call on everybody, and we know that this is a time for us to harvest a lot. Our plan is for our next call on October 9th, which is actually kind of soon. There's less distance between this call and that call than there have been between any of our other calls. We really want to engage with you around these questions. So we want to invite you to go ahead and email us. It's integrallivingroom@gmail.com, and there's a way to email us. You can see that on the Integral Living Room website. If you want to share the thoughts and questions and topics you want us to focus on or input you want to have, we do want to hear it, and we want to make that call a conversation that prepares us as we get ready to show up together in 3D space for the actual event. Did you want to add something to that? Yeah.
Well, what I'd add, Terry, is that we're as inspired by this as you are, and we are very seriously considering making this a regular thing. And I'm talking the 3D space, the actual living room in Boulder. And so we're thinking about doing another session of it in May or June. So for those of you who didn't get in this one and it is sold out, stay tuned, because I hope to be doing this for a long time.
I agree. Because what we're really talking about is in a certain way inviting forward and honing and working with the practices in the same way that we did it with the integral life practice for the individual, where we worked in the spiritual dimension, the psychological dimension, and, you know, the physical dimension to support the transformation of a person. It's not just simply an experience, it's a life practice. So we're really looking at this as developing the practice, the set of practices, the kinds of gathering, the kinds of conversation to do what Ken talked about, which is to practice bringing these higher objects into our experience and therefore participate in the evolution of consciousness, which, as he pointed out, is the only thing we can do at a certain point. So thanks, everybody, for being on the call from me, and I look forward to seeing you on the next call and then also in Boulder.
Yes.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you so much, everybody. Goodbye.
Bye,
everyone.
Have a great few weeks.